Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, giving you a heads up this weekend about a special opportunity next month to hang out with a 101-year-old veteran and support a special cause that's near and dear to his heart. You know, I'm often asked by listeners how they can meet some of the amazing people we get to hear from here on the radio, so here's one of those chances for you, coming up April 22nd with a benefit golf tournament for Castle Air Museum. If you've never been to that museum on the grounds of a now decommissioned Air Force base in Atwater, California, you are missing out on getting up close and personal with planes like an SR-71 Blackbird, a presidential jet, a B-25 like Jimmy Doolittle flew, and a B-17 like the man we're hearing from today, Ralph Graham, served on as a radio man for 33 missions during World War II with the 487th Bomb Group. Ralph turns 101 next month, and a couple weeks after that birthday, he's going to be at this April 22nd golf tournament. You heard him explain how he served in an Army engineer unit and would have been on the ground during the Battle of the Bulge if he hadn't volunteered for aviation cadet training. You can read more of his story in his book, 12 Minutes, The Untold Story of the Ghost Plane at the Battle of the Bulge, which we have linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com.
After the invasion, and we took France, you know, they moved the Air Force aviation and their fighters over so they could follow us all the way around, all the way through the mission.
So you could have fighter escort, not
right.
Be naked.
Yeah. And at that time, there had been enough. Now, remember, this way up in 44, we had just about knocked out every oil target that they had, but they was having to ration gasoline, and that's the reason we wasn't bothered too much with fighter. It was the flak that hurt us worse. And some of the targets are more heavily protected than some. Some of them have as high as 800 guns around it.
And if you flew 33 missions, I have to imagine that you encountered a fair amount of flak.
Oh, we did. Yes, we did.
What was that like for you? Can you help us take us into that,
well,
that B-17? Let us feel what
right.
It felt like?
Well, the worst part really was on what we call the initial point. That's where the bomb bays come open. Doors come open, and we're going to turn it over to the bombardier, and he had to guide that plane exactly on course. We couldn't dodge nothing. When it's about 18 or 20 minutes, you just took whatever came, and that's the part that we couldn't dodge nothing until the bombs went out. And then we could go whichever we wish. I say flak, heavy flak here. We go to the right, left, or up. But that was the worst part. The last 6 or 8 months was the flak.
And can you give us an example of how close it came to you?
Yes, it came awful close. The redder it was when it burst, if you saw red, you know it was right at you. Well, we got used to that, and we'd look and see if it was all black, and you're coming out of the way. But once it starts showing up red, you could hear a little bit of stuff hitting the base of the plane or the body of the plane. And you always felt, well, maybe if I just hit my shoe heel, it'll help. You know, it's that kind of thing. You're just so tense. But, you know, and then, of course, you're sitting there praying. Yeah, and you didn't have really time to do anything. It was awful quiet. Someone asked us if there was any people who didn't believe in God up there. I said, no, not on my plane.
Well, that's always, you know, every member of a bomber crew I've talked to, that's one thing that's always struck me is their perspective on those moments when you know you're flying through a field of flak and there's nothing you can do about it. Sounds pretty helpless.
It is helpless.
So that was your strategy, was sit there and pray?
Absolutely. You had a prayer on your tongue because you didn't know what. I've seen them hit a plane one leading us once. What happened? I'll tell this little story and we'll go back. We went to Berlin, and it was late in the game, and we bombed a target. There wasn't any flak there. They'd moved all those flak guns to the eastern front and used them as artillery pieces. But on the way back, we dropped down to get off oxygen down to 10,000 feet. Well, our lead plane got hit. It blew the nose off. All I could see was just they took it and then just broke it off, even with the back was a pilot area. There wasn't no way that the pilot or the co-pilot or the engineer could live. And I saw two bodies out of that short time that I had to see it. They was in a spread formation like this. One of them was, you know, he didn't have time to even do anything except probably blew his hands up. In fact, we tried, and my pilot had to take over and lead, and that I never could see us. It peeled off about like that, you know, and I watched it as long as I could, but I never seen shoot. So we just assumed, you know, that was complete loss. We were 10,000 feet. They didn't have much time, if they could have.
Yeah.
We didn't know that it didn't, but we just assumed it didn't.
That's got to be hard to watch.
Yeah, it was. It sure was. And then there we was at 10,000 feet, couldn't do nothing but maybe dodge one if we had to. Didn't last long. What they did, they put these AK-AK guns on a barge, and it was on a river, and they didn't do nothing coming in. They just set the trap for us. They knew what we'd do, drop down if we didn't see anything, quick as you could, get off oxygen, you know. Boy, they didn't. We had several of them that hit, but the only thing they hit was pieces that come off of that plane. The nose was knocked off. They didn't get any AK-AK on it, but it was a bunch out of it, and you're not that kind of fright, but you're tore up, you know, till you get home, get you a drink, a couple of drinks. They always interviewed, you know, and they'd give you a drink, a little bourbon, whatever you wanted, so you could talk. They want to know what happened and when and how much damage you did and all that stuff. Really, what they did, they prepared for the next mission on the information they gathered out of us.
Right.
Interview.
Maybe I should have you explain for folks who wouldn't know, your job as a radio operator on that B-17, from takeoff to landing, what are some of the things that you're responsible for?
Okay, well, first of all, at that time we had shooting flak stuff to avoid flak.
Throwing some chaff out or something?
Chaff, that's what I had to throw it all out.
Uh-huh.
But my other jobs was to, if the pilot was uncertain about his direction and he had lost his radio compass, he had asked me to get a QDM or the direction for him to follow. And I'd do that. They'd call it all and tip it in. They'd send it right back, you know. That, and I'd get weather reports, and I'd get send in the bombing results as much as I could, get as much as I could get out of the bombardier.
Mm-hmm.
He was the one that was reporting it. And help the other guys if I could. I didn't have a gun until this bull started, you know, and they pulled one of the gunners off, and I had to take his place.
Well, and that's what your book revolves around, the Battle of the Bulge, and I've heard, you know, from so many guys over the years that were on the ground there freezing their tails off, hoping that the skies would clear so you guys could fly and help them.
Absolutely.
What was it like for you guys waiting for an opportunity to actually fly?
8 days we would sit there. The fog was so thick that you couldn't drive a truck across without some help, flashlights. All we could do is listen. And the report was bad every day, you know, because the Germans, I don't want to get too far in that book because I explained that. The Germans had recognized that there was going to have that fog. We didn't know anything about it, but a young German scientist had discovered a weather condition out over the North Sea that indicated that that was going to happen. So the German command just took advantage of it and prepared everything, tanks and everything. So when the fog came in that night, they took off and they pushed us back, and nobody realized how close they'd drive, like driving us into the sea. That British general, he was on, it's Christmas time. He'd already gone home for Christmas. And they had to get him back. And, of course, there were three armies there they was pushing back. And if they'd pushed us back, they would have delayed us. They might not have lost the war, but they would have delayed us a long, long time.
And how much were you guys aware of, you know, in your bomb group as you're waiting for the opportunity to fly? Did you know what was happening at bulge and how dire
absolutely.
This need was?
Yeah, and we were sitting there helpless.
Mm-hmm.
We got the report every hour, all time during the day, where they were and what was happening.
Mm-hmm.
If they're making a stand or if they're still giving up, still retreating. Then that morning the fog lifted just as fast as it came, you know. You could look up and the stars were shining just like diamonds, you know.
This is Christmas Eve, 1944?
That was right.
Was that unexpected when it cleared that way?
We didn't know. It just came. It just cleared up just like it came, you know.
Uh-huh.
We didn't know that it was going to clear up.
Yeah.
We were sitting there waiting, and about midnight it did. And you could hear all kind of noises, telephones ringing and communications chattering, you know, and they're getting ready for everybody for back some effort, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we knew we might as well get up and get our clothes on.
Here we go.
That's the way it happened. They briefed us on what was happening, where we was going to go. And then from then on, my book takes over. But it didn't last too long. We pulled out on the runway to check, make our final check, and found our problem. And then we had 12 minutes to go back and get another one. And then from then on, it was a mystery.
So you're hitting it. One of the reasons the book is called 12 Minutes. So, and I've heard a lot of these stories over the years of, you know, if it didn't happen just like this, all these other things might have happened. So just so everyone understands and wants to buy the book and read a little more about it, you guys are on the runway. You're getting ready to take off. You're going to go support the troops at the Battle of the Bulge. And there's something wrong with the plane?
That's right. We had to go and pick up another plane that they always have sitting there loaded, ready to go in case somebody has that problem.
Had you guys ever dealt with that before?
No, it's the first time. I don't know. I guess first time our squadron ever done it.
So was that a little unsettling?
It really was. We didn't know what was happening because there was a new plane. The women had just flew it in from the States, hitting several others. We didn't understand. We didn't know I didn't know what was going on anyway. But later he told me what it was.
What was it?
You know, your alternator on a car, if it goes out, you don't have any power.
Right.
When you're sitting on the ground, you're on batteries. But once you're ready to take off, the batteries, you can't go with you. You're depending on electrical current.
Right.
And we checked them, and it always going to fall a little bit, you know. But this one went from peg down. That means you may not even get off the runway, depending on how much, what it was putting out.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't take any kind of a chance.
So you guys have to go back, and everybody gets off this B-17, you transfer onto another one.
Right, and it took about 12 minutes.
Uh-huh. How big a difference did that 12 minutes make?
Well, it made a lot. We started, I thought we ought to abort, because you could take a pencil and a tablet and figure out yourself in small and just arithmetic. There wasn't no way we could catch them before they get to the target.
Because you've got a whole group of B-17s.
They're 40 miles ahead, and we'd had to make up that time. And we came 225 miles as fast as you can go with a load. If we had to increase that enough to get there, we wouldn't have made it anyway.
So you're not going to catch up and become part of the formation.
That's
just
right.
Not going to happen.
So we flew on. No, I didn't know what we were going to do. And we got a call from him.
From General Castle?
General Castle said, we're under attack. Well, the pilot said, well, now what we should do? He said, just join another crew. Well, it wasn't long after that till he was shot down. Tried to contact him, but he was done gone.
So if you had been with the original group of planes, you would have been part of that fighter attack as well.
That's right. And I'll tell you, as we go along, we went ahead and finally made it. It was pretty tough to even join another group because they don't like to see a single plane come up to join without reporting why you're doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Because the Germans did take one of them old planes that crashed and pick it up, and they'd come back and fly it and get in the contrails and cause a lot of problems, you know.
Sure.
So we joined them, and it was, wanted to know what our armor was. We told him we were carrying 2 500-pounders. He said, that's what we need. We're going to knock a bridge out over a certain river. We didn't know what river it was because we wasn't briefed for that mission, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what we did. We knocked it out and came back and finally went home. And when we got home, we found out what had happened, that they had said they'd knocked down 9 planes. Well, said 4 of them that was knocked down by the German fighters, and the rest of them had force landed or built out there at Liège. It was a little town outside of Brussels. And we found out that they had made that mistake. They thought we was down because of our squadron commander, who didn't fly that day, looked at us and says, I'm looking at a ghost. Says, y'all was reported dead, down, or missing. Nobody knew whether it was which one it was. And as far as I was concerned, I tried to figure out why he didn't report it.
He didn't report
us as missing,
mm-hmm.
But he didn't report it that there was SJ-8 planes, because we was in the ninth.
You would have been the ninth plane, but instead there were only eight.
That's right. There's only eight because they thought they was right, and they were, because there was only four reported back.
Mm-hmm.
But if you take four and you add us, and that's five, and you subtract that from 13, you get eight. See? That's one of the reasons I wrote the book, and nobody ever knew the difference. They even made a report article on that mission, and they still reported nine planes missing. And then I got a little piece of that letter in my book. You can magnify it and see whether they still said nine planes missing.
And that was the official Army Air Corps report of the mission?
That's right. It was such a mixed up thing, you know. In addition to that, we had 50 airplanes that came in and landed on our. And there we were. Christmas was an eve. Christmas Day was next day, and they was boiling turkey and everything, getting ready. But the confusion just wiped out any reason for any of them to ever doubt, other than that fact that he told us.
So let me understand. So you guys go ahead. You join another group. You're not with your squadron. You're flying with another group. You drop your 500-pound bombs on the target, and then you're flying back to your base. But when your pilot brings the plane down and you land, you get off, you guys see the squadron commander?
Yeah, that's right. He walked into the headquarters.
Uh-huh.
Our pilot did.
When your pilot walks in?
He looked at, and they were really good friends. He said, man, I'm looking at a ghost.
Mm-hmm.
Because they were already reported, as quick as it happened, that the one that took over reported the one that wasn't there. They knew who was flying, and they knew the one that joined them was four planes. That's how come them was sank. Well, there's nine plane mission. They didn't know. Say nobody had any idea that we wasn't in the group. Avon Castle didn't know until he called us and called everybody and said, we're under attack. And we was listening, and we called him back. And he said, just go on around. We told him he was 40 miles away. Just go ahead and join another group.
You know, you've had a lot of time to think about this.
Absolutely.
I imagine you may have some different emotions for different aspects of it. What are some of the things you think about when you consider that twist of fate or the uniqueness of the difference that 12 minutes made in your life and others?
I wrote it down. It's in there. And I said this. The Germans had 8 days that they didn't fly. We had 8 days. We didn't fly. You had any time to make proposals on what to do. The Germans prepared too. But when it came to be, the Germans was prepared. We wasn't. Because who's going to send out the whole 8th Air Force being led by a squadron that didn't have one escort plane?
Mm-hmm.
But yet there was thousands of them in the area, but we didn't have one.
It's time for our final break, but we'll get more of an explanation on that when we come back. If you'd like to shake the hand of the man whose story you're hearing today, sign up for that charity golf tournament supporting Central California's Castle Air Museum on April 22nd. All that information online for you at hometownheroesradio.com. And hey, this centenarian, Ralph Graham's going to be flying in from Texas for the occasion. So whatever state you're listening from today, maybe you could do the same. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. Over 1,500 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.